Chapter 14. Is this a good place for a campsite? Adams looked around skeptically.
That looks good to me. I couldn't see what she didn't like.
The site where we had set down the dropships was at the top of a low, rounded knoll, with good views of the surrounding countryside in three directions. Most of the ground was meadows, with low-growing grasses and shrubs, so we didn't have to clear a lot of trees to make room for dropships and tents. Groves of trees were scattered here and there for shade. There was a stream less than 100 meters away, and a breeze from the east cooled the air and kept bugs away.
What's wrong with it?
She reached down and plucked a leaf off the ground.
These are deciduous trees.
She paused to see if I knew what that meant. I nodded, so she continued.
They lose their leaves. That means it can get cold here.
Do you want to be here during the winter? We have no idea how harsh the climate can be at this latitude.
She had a good point.
I like the change of seasons, I mused. The shelters are heated, and we can build cabins eventually.
Build cabins, sir?
She was clearly not buying into that concept.
Yeah, why not? There are plenty of trees in the forests around here. We can use stones, I nudged a rock with my boot, to make fireplaces.
Sounds cozy.
Her tone of voice said the opposite.
Come on, Adams. Where's your sense of adventure and romance? We can rough it over the winter like the pioneers did.
Rough it like trudging through deep snow to use the latrine?
Oh, that's not roughing it. I mean true suffering and deprivation.
Her eyes grew wide.
Like what?
No Netflix, I said with a wink.
No. Ha ha.
Hey, the pioneers didn't have Netflix.
Or Wi-Fi, she added. I don't know how they survived.
All right, you have a point that we don't know what winters are like here. If we are going to be stuck on gingerbread long term, we should understand the climate first. I'll ask Skippy to study that. In the meantime, we'll set up a base camp here. We need to fly around to survey the planet, and this place is as good as any to start from.
Good, Joe, Skippy interjected. Let someone else do the surveying. You should stay here. It wouldn't be good for you to wander off into the woods and get lost.
Hey, I'm a soldier, and I spent a lot of time in the backwoods of Maine. I'm pretty decent at wilderness survival, Skippy.
Oh, sure. You're a regular crocodile dum-dum.
Setting up base camp was a lot of work, and somehow I got stuck assembling portable latrines. I tilted my head after the first one was ready.
This looks kind of like an oversized phone booth, I observed.
Major Smythe chuckled.
Colonel, how would you know what a phone booth looks like? You're too young to ever have used one.
Well, they have phone booths in Montreal. Or they did a couple years ago.
Montreal?
Adams looked at me with a raised eyebrow.
It's in Canada. You know, the country north of the U.S.
That's a separate country? She asked with dry humor. I always thought that was Baja, Alaska.
Or North, North Dakota. I laughed. Thought phone booths were advanced Canadian technology, instead of having to carry a phone everywhere with you. I pulled out my Z-phone and waved it.
Just go to a phone booth.
That's not the full story about you and phone booth, Joe,
Skippy said with a twinkle in his voice, if that was possible.
Ah, oh, crap, don't tell that story, Skippy.
Adams was not going to let that remark go by.
What happened, sir?
Joe thought he was Superman, Skippy chuckled. I hid my face behind my hands.
You have to understand, Canadian club whiskey is an evil, evil thing. Joe and his friends were bar hopping, and he decided it was too hot to wear long pants, so he went into a phone booth to change. Only he is not Superman, and he didn't have shorts to change into, and this phone booth didn't have a door.
Yeah, and you know how everyone says Canadians are all so polite?
I shook my head.
And those police officers were not so polite.
I have never been that drunk, Adams declared, with what I took to be a mixture of disgust and admiration.
You don't ever want to be. Thinking about Canadian Club made me queasy.
Well, the cops did let me go after I put my pants back on, but they made my friends take me straight back to the hotel. Anyway, I should stay out of Canada for a while.
Probably a good idea, Joe, Skippy agreed. I checked the setup instructions for the latrine, which was a Kristang device we took off their troop ship. It says here you can make the outside of this thing change color, even camouflage it.
Yes, Joe, Skippy explained patiently. There are options for multiple colors. For finishes, you can choose either matte or glossy, Skippy explained.
Matte and glossy. I think they do mornings at Z-107, I grinned.
What? Adams asked with a laugh.
You know, I used my most jive DJ voices.
I'm Matt, and I'm glossy, and this is Z-107, FM's Morning Zoo. Matt, a truckload of maple syrup spilled on Route 6 near Vanceboro this morning. Thanks, Glossy. It sounds like a sticky situation. Yuck, yuck, yuck.
Joe, Skippy sighed while everyone else laughed. Did your mother drop you on the head as a child?
Nope, Skippy, I'm just like this.
I weep for your species.
Yeah, my Uncle Edgar used to say that about me, too.
Near the southern edge of the campsite, there was a crowd of people standing around, looking at something on the ground. Several of them had hands on their hips or arms across their chests, both of which were bad signs. I walked over to find seven guys and Margaret Adams staring at a shallow hole in the dirt.
What's up? I directed the question at Lieutenant Williams, leader of our SEALs team.
We were setting up this shelter, he gestured toward the partially unfolded structure laying on the ground. And we got three of the pins set to secure the corners. When we tried to drive in the pin here, we hit an obstruction. Moving the pin one way or another didn't help. The problem is this rock.
They had dug down about 6 inches to expose the top of the rock in question. This was not some red shale that could be flaked away with a pickaxe. This rock was gray and solid, and already dirt was scratched away from shovels hitting it, exposing the light gray bare rock beneath the encrusting soil. This was a serious rock, and it was serious about making us go someplace else to set up a shelter.
Can we dig around it, see how big it is? I suggested.
Or, Adams pointed a short distance away, we could move the shelter to the flat ground between those two trees. It's like, she squinted into the sun, 20 feet.
Since Adams's proposal was clearly ridiculous, we ignored her. Taking turns with shovels, we found the edges of the rock after 10 minutes of sweaty labor in the afternoon sun. Tossing my shovel on the ground, I considered the stubborn rock, taking off my UNEF baseball cap and scratching my head.
That is a damn big rock. It will take forever to dig this thing out, I observed.
Yeah. Williams kicked the rock with a boot. If we had a truck or some kind of winch, we could pull it out.
I agreed.
But we don't. We're not using a dropship to lift it out, are we?
No. I shot down that idea.
Two people with powered armor, Major Smythe began to suggest, but I cut him off.
I don't want to risk the suits we brought, I stated.
With limited space aboard the dropships and fearing this may be a one-way trip in which food and medicine was more important than combat capability, we only brought 8 sets of Kristang-powered armor with us. We also had 6 Theranin combots and plenty of ammo for both weapon systems.
So we give up? Williams asked, disappointed.
Oh, hell no. I had known that rock for only 10 minutes, and already I hated the stupid thing. I shook my head.
What do we have for explosives?
Oh, my God, Adams gasped. You've got to be joking.
Major Smythe rightfully ignored her.
There are those Theranin grenades for the combots. We are running low on combots, but we are well fixed for grenades.
Adams threw up her hands in disbelief and walked away, shaking her head. I was familiar with the grenades Smythe mentioned.
Those grenades have a shape charge setting, right? I asked, already knowing the answer.
One of those should split this rock easily.
Perhaps, Smythe cautioned.
We don't know how deep this rock goes.
Well, I don't want to dig down enough to find out. Let's have a grenade do the hard work for us.
Williams retrieved a grenade from the weapons locker of a Falcon dropship, and he and another SEAL placed it on the rock, using explosive-driven anchors to hold it in place. Then we evacuated the whole camp behind a slope just to the north, with the science team and some others questioning our sanity.
"Fire in the hole!" Williams shouted, and remotely detonated the grenade.
The ground shook slightly, and there was a sharp cracking sound. Then fine dust and pebbles rained down on our heads. The result was, to say the least, a disappointment. When we gathered around the rock, this time with a larger crowd of curious onlookers, we saw a large split down the middle, and part of the top was missing. But the bulk of the stubborn boulder was still there, mocking us. Based on what we could see by shining lights down through the crack, I estimated the rock extended down 5 feet. Considering the roughly spherical shape with a diameter of 5 feet and the average density of a granite-type stone, that made it, five times, something about pi. It was really heavy. Well, shit. Now I really hated that stupid rock.
With the crack going all the way down, we can fit a grenade in there now. Set it for a dispersal blast, Williams noted, pulling another grenade from his pocket.
Those grenades have a variable yield? I inquired.
Yes, sir.
Williams showed me the tiny dial on one end of the device, a dial sized for smaller Theranin hands.
This one goes to 11.
He pointed to the maximum indicator on the dial.
We could dial it down.
The look he gave me clearly was intended to dissuade me from taking that ridiculous suggestion.
No, I snorted. I want this rock, I kicked the stupid thing with the toe of a boot, to die. I can hear it, laughing at us.
The camp was evacuated once more with some louder grumbling that the whole exercise was a waste of time. Most of the grumbling came from women. By now, all the men were eager to see what a Theranin grenade could do to a solid rock. Besides, it was, you know, majorly cool. 11 was a lot. The explosion, mostly contained by being inside the rock, had more force than I expected. One basketball-sized chunk of rock went high in the air, and we had a brief moment of terror trying to guess where it would come down before it arced over our huddled group and crashed into a tree behind us, knocking limbs off on its way to bounce along the ground.
Woohoo!
I high-fived several people, and I wasn't the only one. The steady wind blew the dust away from us, and we were able to approach the former rock's position quickly.
Huh, I said quietly. That's a big freaking hole.
Yep, Williams agreed. The hole was 10 feet in diameter and about 6 deep, with dirt thrown 10 feet in every direction. The only sign of the rock was little pebbles collected in the bottom of the hole. As we stood there, more pebbles slid down the sides to the bottom.
Damn, sir. It will take a while to fill in that hole so we can set the pin for the shelter.
That's too much work, I declared. Let's set up the shelter on the flat ground between those two trees. I pointed about 20 feet away.
Unbelievable, Adam shouted and stomped off in disgust.
Women, I said as I rolled my eyes.
Good idea, sir, Williams agreed. The trees will provide shade from the afternoon sun.
He held out a fist.
We showed that rock who's boss, huh?
Oh, yeah. I bumped his fist.
We sure did.
Gingerbread had the blessed advantage of gravity almost Earth-normal, a welcome relief for the merry band of pirates. The worst planet I had landed on, Jumbo, had gravity high enough that simply sleeping hurt because your body got sore from laying in one position for more than 10 minutes. Surface gravity on Gingerbread was only 2% more than on Earth. You might think a 2% difference would not be noticeable, and maybe the extra strain I felt was all in my head, but we all felt it. After being in zero gravity aboard the stricken Dutchman, then coasting through space in dropships without artificial gravity, every one of us was feeling the effects of muscle atrophy. We took fancy Theranin drugs that supposedly counteracted some of the damage from long-term zero gravity, but when we landed on Gingerbread, my legs wobbled. For the first 2 days, I was getting my strength back, and on the third morning I went for an easy run with the Indian team. Or it was what Captain Chandra described as an easy run, a mere 10 kilometers over relatively flat ground along a river. When I was in high school, I suddenly decided, because I am thoroughly an idiot, to run a marathon. A woman my mother worked with had qualified for the Boston Marathon, and she was going to run it the next April. The whole town was excited for her. So when school started that year, I began training for a marathon. To make a long story short,
I did everything you shouldn't do, like piling on the miles too fast. Then I twisted an ankle playing football in the third game of the season, so that ended my epic quest for distance running glory. Anyway, the reason a 26.2-mile race is called a marathon is that according to legend, an ancient Greek named Pheidippides ran all the way to Athens to announce the Greek army's victory over the Persians at a place called Marathon. No, Pheidippides wasn't ancient. I think he was a young guy. I meant this happened in ancient Greece. Anyway, the story goes that after this Pheidippides guy reached Athens and reported the news, he collapsed and died. Apparently he hadn't properly hydrated along the way because Gatorade didn't exist yet. Which makes me wonder, the Greeks didn't have horses? Or was Pheidippides just a macho idiot? "Hey, I could ride a horse," he said. "But anyone could do that. I'll run the whole way." And what a bonehead. The point of my story is that during the last 100 meters of his run, just before he collapsed and died, Pheidippides felt way better than I did running with the Indian paratrooper team that morning. It was a 3-Ralph run for me. I stopped 3 times to puke up whatever was left in my stomach from the night before. To my shame, I was the only one who Ralphed until the 6th kilometer when even Captain Chandra leaned to the side and upchucked. On the way back, after 8 kilometers, Chandra wisely called a halt because people were stumbling, and by people I do not mean only people named Joe Bishop. The final kilometer back into camp was done at a steady jogging pace to keep up our pride. It didn't work. Major Smythe had been testing some of our cool Kristang recon drones, and when we got back to camp, gasping and red-faced, he strolled nonchalantly over to Chandra, showing the Indian leader a Z-phone image. "Nice route you ran," Smythe said with a tight smile. "It was good training for the drone operators."
"You followed us?" Chandra asked, humiliated.
"Yes, the whole way."
Chandra said some curse word in Hindi that got his team laughing.
"Don't worry," Smythe patted Chandra's shoulder. "My team nearly had to carry me back yesterday."
Hearing that made me feel better. Also, I always feel better right after I puke. A couple days later, it was my turn to fly a recon mission, this time to the west of base camp. We sent out 3 recon birds that day. Mine was first to leave because I was super incredibly excited to be flying anything, anywhere. My co-pilot had a bemused smile on her face throughout the pre-flight inspection, and our 2 relief pilots settled into seats in the passenger cabin still sipping cups of coffee because I insisted we lift off at first light. The plan was for me to fly the outbound leg, then the relief pilots would take over. Our flight was not a grid search. All we wanted was to get an idea of the land beyond base camp. With the damned fuzz field creating a fog all across the electromagnetic spectrum, we at first had no idea whether base camp was on an island or smack in the middle of a continent or close to the coast of a vast ocean. Recon birds to the north, south, and east the first 2 days revealed there was an ocean 800 kilometers to the south and 1,100 clicks to the east. North of us were rolling hills, swampland, and a sort of tundra that was in its summer season. The flights had not seen any signs of civilization, past or present, which was no surprise, but Skippy cautioned us against drawing any conclusions from such limited data. With the fuzz field squelching all sensor data, the recon ships had to fly low to see the ground at all, so their visibility was limited to about a 10-kilometer strip of land to either side of the flight path. Flying low allowed the sensors in the bellies of the ships to scan the ground for anything that might help us locate an Elder conduit. It also burned a lot more fuel, because the turbine engines operated less efficiently in thicker air. All dropships were a compromise design between aircraft and spacecraft, and none of them liked flying low and slowly enough for the sensors to get a useful scan of the surface.
"Anything, Skippy?" I asked after about 2 hours of flight time.
Flying west, we had the rising sun behind us. Although we were flying so slowly, the sun was advancing across the landscape faster than our Dragon. Vague shadows that were long and stretched out when we took off were now shortening as the indistinct blob of the sun climbed into the sky.
"Nothing obvious," Skippy replied from base camp.
"I can't see much with the skimpy signal bandwidth anyway," he complained.
The only way recon flights could maintain contact with base camp and with each other was for the ships to eject relay pods every couple kilometers. The pods we used were a Theranin design. Sims had found a whole crate of them aboard the Dutchman, but we hadn't used them much until we landed on Gingerbread. They were only about the size of a ping-pong ball and almost as light. The things got ejected from a special port in the belly of our dropships and floated to the surface without needing parachutes. Even with pods relaying a signal all the way back to base camp, we were pretty much restricted to voice communications. Skippy couldn't process the recorded sensor data until each dropship returned to base camp. It was annoying and frustrating, and it potentially wasted a lot of time. If a dropship flew over something interesting, we wouldn't know that until much later, and then we would need to send another bird out to more closely inspect the area. So far, Skippy hadn't found a conduit or anything like it. The only encouraging sign was that Gingerbread was apparently honeycombed with tunnels and caverns beneath the placid surface. If we were going to find a conduit on Gingerbread, Skippy thought it most likely would be underground. A conduit there would be protected from meteor impacts, weather, erosion of the surface, and would have access to abundant geothermal power. Meteor impacts apparently were a big problem in the Gingerbread system. We saw plenty of impact craters while we were flying around, and Skippy told us there were plenty more that weren't obvious, being so old they had partly filled in or covered with trees. Personally, I found meteor impact craters fascinating and asked Skippy to tell me more about them, but he was super busy weeding through sensor data to find a conduit and told me that my curiosity would have to wait for later. "Okay, thanks," I replied to let him know we appreciated what little he was able to do for us. "Hey, Skippy, should we fly over this lake?" I asked as I craned my neck to see over the Dragon's console. With the Ran in dropships, our problem was seats that were too small and ceilings that were too low for humans. And the already tiny bathrooms were extra cramped. We brought equipment from Earth to replace the seats, the low ceilings and cramped bathrooms we had to live with as best we could. A more significant problem was the cockpit controls were sized for smaller Theranin bodies and hands, which caused problems of clumsy human fingers brushing against the wrong controls. Because the Theranin were cyborgs who normally flew their ships through chips in their brains, they had not given a lot of thought to the physical flight controls that were considered emergency backups only. With the Krestang dropships that we called Dragons, we had the opposite problem. Most humans were too small to properly fit in the cockpit seats and use the controls without awkwardness. In the Dragon that day, Lieutenant Reed was in the left-hand seat, and although she was taller than average for a woman, she had the seat adjusted up and forward almost to its maximum travel. I am taller than average, being about 6'3", but the top of the co-pilot console in front of me cut off the lower part of the wraparound forward display that replaced vulnerable cockpit windows. To get an optimal view of the lake, I had to push myself up in my seat. "Yes, Joe, you should fly over the lake," Skippy snapped with irritation. "Stick to the flight plan and leave the thinking to me. Damn, maybe I should have taped a banana to the nose of your Dragon so you would follow it." "You are hilarious, Skippy," I said dryly, as Lieutenant Reed's shoulders shook with laughter. "I was thinking that being over deep water might interfere with our sensor scans." "Thinking? Is that what you call it?" "Huh. Let me give you an example of actual thinking, Joe. The lake in front of you is deep, and that is a good thing. It means below the lake there is less dirt and rock that will interfere with the sensor scans. Water is easy to see through, and I can adjust the sensors to ignore the effects of deep water. So," he sighed sarcastically, "if it is okay with you, please stick to the flight plan." "Got it," I replied curtly, embarrassed. "Descending to 100 meters above the water," I advised Reed. I was in the co-pilot seat, but at the moment I was pilot in command, primarily responsible for the flight. Reed had flown us most of the way from base camp, with most of that on autopilot. She had turned the controls over to me not because I was a commanding officer, but because most of my experience flying a Dragon had been in a simulator, and she knew I wanted stick time. Dragons did not have an actual control stick, and that was an old expression we brought from Earth. Instead of a control stick or yoke, the primary flight controls were flat screens. The middle finger of my right hand rested on a circle in the display. Pushing the circle forward made the Dragon's nose drop. Pulling the circle back lifted the nose. Banking right or left was accomplished by pushing the circle in the appropriate direction. The flight computer mostly handled coordinating the rudder for turns, although my index finger had independent rudder control, and I tried to fly manually as much as possible. My right pinky finger controlled the engine throttles. If the port and starboard engines needed to be throttled separately, I could use thumb and pinky finger. The Krestang Warrior cast were hateful, murderous lizards, but they made sweet flight controls. After a day or two of getting used to controlling almost everything with one hand, I didn't want to go back to the ironically clumsier Theranin physical flight controls.
"Descending to 100 meters AGL," Reed acknowledged, letting me do all the flying.
She was monitoring the sensor gear and really didn't have much to do. Skippy remotely controlled the sensors and would tell us immediately if there was a problem that required our attention. We had the sensor pod in the belly of the Dragon actively scanning straight down to map out the underground cavern network, with the belly pod sending out powerful active pulses that could penetrate deep beneath the surface. The sensitivity of the other sensors was dialed back to prevent interference. That left us a bit more blind than normal flying procedure and left me a bit uncomfortable. Yes, we were flying above an uninhabited planet under a mostly clear sky, and there were no known threats. The closest air traffic was another Dragon on its way back to base, safely half an hour flight time from us, and even if all our sensor gear was operating at maximum sensitivity, the odd fuzzing field enveloping the entire planet would have limited us to seeing in a 23-kilometer radius at best. Everything beyond that distance was indistinct and often false. Hills appeared beyond sensor range, but when we flew closer, those hills disappeared into flat marshland. Why the Elders had bothered to conceal the surface of that planet was a question Skippy could not answer. Why the Elders were continuing to conceal the surface long after they had left the galaxy behind bothered me a lot. Skippy didn't have an answer for that question either, and I know it bothered him too. It probably bothered him a lot more than it made me uneasy. For me, the Elders were a curiosity. For Skippy, they were his heritage, and the more he examined that heritage, the less he realized he truly knew of his origin. "Hey, what do you know?" I asked cheerily, using my left hand to point in front of us. "There is actually a lake." Reed grinned. In this case, the long-range sensor data through the all-encompassing fuzz field had been accurate, although some details had been false. The long-range data had showed two islands in the middle of the lake, but now we could see the lake surface was uninterrupted by any islands except a few small rocks along the shore. Why the Elders had chosen to conceal some terrain features and display other features as they truly were was another mystery. The basic outline of the lake was correct, as were the hills that surrounded the water. Hills on the west side to our starboard were taller and more rugged, densely covered with dark trees. The hills to the east rolled gently, and the forests were dotted with irregularly shaped meadows. "Leveling off at 100 meters AGL," I declared. The lake was long and narrow but big, like what I guess a Scottish loch looked like. Thinking of lakes in Scotland, I found myself visually scanning the water for sign of a monster, then ruefully shook my head and returned my attention to the flight controls. "Sensors?"
"Nominal," Reed reported distractedly, her focus directed to the portside display. "Sir, those meadows, do they look odd to you?"
"Meadows?" Until she mentioned the hillside clearings to our east, I had not given them any thought. At first, I couldn't understand what she could mean. The hills were partly dark forests and lighter-colored meadows, with the meadows covering more land down toward the lake. Farther south along the lakeshore, the forests fell away to form isolated groves of trees and tree lines between meadows. It was odd. Whatever was growing in the meadows was a sort of grass or shrub, anywhere from light green to bright yellow in color. That wasn't what I found odd. What was odd, what was unnatural, was that each meadow contained only one type of plant. Real meadows were scattered with a random variety of plants. And real meadows didn't have tree lines acting as windbreaks between fields of crops.
"Those are not meadows," I said with alarm.
"That's cropland." As I spoke, my pinky finger advanced the throttles and I pulled the nose up. Too late.
"Missile warning,"
Reed shouted as her fingers flew over the controls, killing the active sensor pulses, engaging the stealth field, shields, and defensive maser turrets. If we had a couple more seconds for those systems to warm up, it might have helped. As we did not have extra seconds,
A missile exploded below and behind us, sending shrapnel ripping into the belly, both wings, and both engines. The impact tossed the tail high in the air, and for a moment, the dragon hung vertically in the air before the nose plunged straight down. We were lucky the dropship hadn't flipped over on its back upside down in the air. Lieutenant Reed, with my clumsy help, managed to use the last thrust from the shredded engine turbines to level out our flight before we hit the water hard. The dragon bounced twice hard, the impacts making my head rattle in the helmet. Then the stricken craft skidded across the water, slowing rapidly. The nose dug into the water one last time with an explosion of white foam rushing over the cockpit displays before they cut out. Then we shuddered to a halt. "Holy shit!" I shouted as I pulled off my now useless helmet. "Everyone out!" Reed shouted more usefully. "We're sinking!" In the cockpit, we could not use the ejection seats because the ejection system in a Krystang Dragon dropship pushed the pilot and co-pilot seats downward, and there was a whole lot of water beneath us. Attempting to eject would result in Reed and I being crushed by impact with the water. The ejection system was probably smart enough to refuse to activate anyway. "Right behind you," I acknowledged, struggling with the bulky harness latch. "You first, sir," Reed hesitated, though she was already free of her seat. "That's an order, Reed," I barked as the stubborn harness latch freed itself. The cockpit door was behind her anyway. She would have had to wait for me to slip by her, and that made no sense. Following orders, she staggered out the door with water rushing in already ankle deep. When I got my head around the doorframe, I could see why. Our two relief pilots, sensibly not waiting for an engraved invitation to abandon ship, had engaged the emergency explosives to blow the starboard side door open and were already outside the dragon. Perched precariously on the stubby starboard wing, they were shouting and gesturing for us to hurry, as the cabin was one-third full of water and more was pouring in from cracks in the port side hull. The dragon, which had initially come to rest slightly nose down, was now tilting to the rear rapidly. "Go!" I shouted to Reed right in front of me, and we both struggled through the cold knee-deep water, clutching seat backs and staggering along as fast as we could. Reed hesitated as she got a couple fingers on the railing by the door, looking back at me. "Go!" I repeated. "You're in my way!" I added, appealing to her logic. She saw the sense in going first, holding on to the railing and reaching up with the other for someone outside to grasp. Whoever it was, held her right hand with both of his and pulled her up and out. She almost made it, but just as her shoulders reached the doorframe, the dragon tilted violently, sinking sharply down by the rear. The dropship stood on its tail, and a crack in the starboard hull split open wide, letting in a jet of cold lake water. I lost my grip on a chair and fell face first into the water, bashing my left shoulder on a submerged seat. Choking and gasping, I flailed my arms wildly and ineffectively, being tossed around like a rag doll as the heavy dragon spun on its tail and plunged downward. Dark water swirled and bounced me around so I couldn't tell which direction was up, until I suddenly could hear loud noises no longer muffled by water. When my head popped above the water, I saw one of Reed's feet splash. Then she was out the door that was completely underwater. The surging water carried me upward through the cockpit and smacked my head on the forward bulkhead. Dazed, I tried to suck in a lungful of air so I could swim down to the open side door. I got half a mouthful of air and half a mouthful of water, and when I tried to swim downward, the inflowing water forced me back up against the forward bulkhead. Seeing no other option, I felt my way to the cockpit door where the water pushed me in, nearly tearing my right arm off. The cockpit still had red emergency lighting on, allowing me to blearily see the door controls. I slapped the button, and to my amazement, the door closed almost all the way. Next to the door was a recessed crank that I pulled out, grinding harder and harder. Something was wrong with the door. The frame or track might have been warped by the crash. It took all my might to force the manual crank the last two turns, with my injured right arm screaming agony. Then the door sealed, and water stopped flowing in. "Great. That was brilliant, Joe," I told myself. I sealed myself into a falling tomb. Closing the cockpit door had been desperate instinct. I thought of taking refuge there until the dragon came to rest on the bottom of the lake. At the time, I had not remembered how deep the lake was. Now I remembered. It was deep. Like, really deep for a lake.
My last glimpse of the outside world before the dragon hit the water had shown we came down near the west shore. How far from the shore? The lake was more shallow right around the shore. Then the bottom fell like a cliff for hundreds of meters. How deep was the water where we had come down? It had no way of knowing, but the dragon's continuing tail-first downward plunge was not encouraging. The fall seemed to be steady, not accelerating. But the dragon was going to hit bottom soon. When that happened, it was unlikely to be gentle. Quickly, I pulled myself up by one arm into the seat just abandoned by Reed and strapped myself in. I almost laughed as my discarded helmet bobbed to the surface like a loyal puppy. I picked it up with the right arm that was shooting hot flashes of pain, poured out water, and jammed it back on my head, pulling the chin strap tight. The seats had a feature that could engage a safety strap with the back of the helmet. I prayed as I rubbed the helmet against the back of the seat, hoping it would engage by itself. It did. My feet slid into loops under the seat, and I placed my hands on my lap in the proper procedure for a crash or ejection. In this case, I anticipated hitting the lake bottom, and I wasn't bothering to hope it would be gentle. It wasn't. With the displays and instruments out, I could only judge motion by my inner ears and by my teeth, because they rattled in my mouth when the tail crunched on whatever it hit. However fast the dragon had been falling, it had enough energy to bounce off the bottom and hit again. The whole ship shuddered, and for a split second it hung balanced on the flattened tail structure. Then it spun to the right and came down on its belly. Water sloshed around the cockpit, slamming me against the seat. I thought that was the end of it, but the dragon must have impacted on an underwater slope because it rolled again and kept rolling, tumbling side to side many times and nose over tail at least twice. The final impact was jarring enough that a needle-thin jet of water shot into the cockpit from a pinhole crack in the starboard hull. After rocking side to side for a moment, partly due to water sloshing around inside, the dragon came to rest mostly on its belly, with the nose up at a 45-degree angle, judging by the water collected in the cockpit. Where was I? With no immediate incentive to move, I stayed securely in the seat, waiting to make sure the dragon wasn't going to slip on some rocks and fall again. That's what I told myself. The truth was, I was so stunned and scared I couldn't move. What got me moving was the high-pitched hissing of that jet of water coming in. It was annoying, and it hurt my ears listening to it. It was also an immediate threat, a threat I knew how to deal with. The dropship had kits under the seatbacks to seal hull breaches. The patches in these kits were designed for use in vacuum. We had never tested them in water, especially not in deep, cold water. I was shivering from being in that icy lake water. Would the cold prevent the patch material from solidifying? Well, there was only one way to tell. But crap! As I pulled out a patch, I realized they were designed to be used in a vacuum, where the force of air getting sucked out of the cabin would guide the patch material to find the leak. In the lake, the leak caused water to pour in at high pressure. No way would the patch work. I was totally screwed. Until I remembered Skippy's flying circus. Desai had flown a big Thurenan Condor dropship deep in the atmosphere of a gas giant to extract fuel for the Dutchman's reactors. Part of the training for that mission had been sealing the cabin against leaks of high-pressure toxic gases from the gas giant. While I had not trained for that flight, I had watched the training, so I could understand what was involved and get an understanding of the dangers. The Thurenan kit to seal a leak coming into the cabin used a sort of tube with a trigger. Did the kit in the Kristang Dragon have something like that? It did. I found two of them. Being short of time and being a guy, I of course did not bother to attempt reading the instructions. In my defense, the instructions were printed in Kristang script, and my ability to read Kristang was limited to things like danger and bathroom. Also, the patch kits were intended to be used in emergency situations. They had to operate intuitively, as panicked people could not be expected to handle anything complex. I got the sharp nose of the tube jammed as well as I could into the pinhole, to the point I had to close my eyes as water now sprayed in all directions. The water tried to knock the tube from my hands as I pulled the trigger. There was a muffled bang, the tube jerked in my hands, and a harsh chemical stink filled the cabin. And the leak stopped. Some of the orange foam hardened quickly, becoming rigid. The hissing sound of incoming water stopped. I was safe. No, that was bullshit. I was still screwed. And alone. At the bottom of a lake.